You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing. Welcome to Intersections. My name is Randy Papworth.
And my name is Anastasia Haywood-Chubatov.
Today we will be discussing the hypersexualization of women of color and the results of the hypersexualization, including violence against women of color. This episode will contain discussions about violence against women of color. So to start off our topic, we're going to discuss teachers. And I believe Anastasia did some research on this topic.
Sure. I focused on Asian female teachers to talk about because violence against Asians has increased during the pandemic, and it is something and I wanted to focus on also how it affects Asian people in everyday life and in their professions. And I wanted to start off by just saying that there's a real lack of research on Asian teachers, and I feel like that goes for a lot of issues that with minorities, indigenous women and girls, there's a huge lack of research for their murders and them going missing. And then for men, they were completely, the National Inquiry said that they would not accept male indigenous cases, even though they're 3 times more likely than non-indigenous people to get murdered. And I just wanted to mention that right off the bat, because I feel like that's a way for people I mean, I'm white, so I've never experienced I don't have any personal experience in this, and there could be during this episode, if I say anything that isn't true to the experience, I apologize, because I feel like I do lack insight on that. But I just think often when you're trying to make your case about your experience in some way, the easiest way for someone else to gaslight you is to say, oh, what's the research on that? And if there's a lack of research on Asian teachers or violence against Asians, violence against indigenous people, violence against all women, people of color, then it's more easily to be gaslit. So I just wanted to mention that right off the bat. So for Asian teachers, there's been an increase in Asian students in North America over the past years, and it's 40% of the population of students in North America. Yet for teachers, there's 17% are teachers that are of color, and even less that are Asian teachers. And this research article was just was talking about. Was interviewing 11 Asian female teachers, and they said that they're usually the only Asian teacher in the faculty, and their experiences are that, from other teachers, they get often, they're focused on their beauty a lot, one where, oh, you should wear a sexy black dress to the party, or she remembered telling this other white teacher, I'm Filipina, and his eyes lit up, and he was saying how, and after that, he would always say that she was beautiful and she should wear her hair down, and that they feel like they've been patted and they've been touched. They've been prodded, they've been by other teachers. And that generally their physicality is focused on, and it's super unprofessional. And that also, because there's such a lack of Asian teachers, that, and teachers of color that they remember even studying to be a teacher, that a lot of the 11 people didn't have any experience learning with another person of color to become a teacher or have someone like teaching them who was a person of color, and especially a woman of color. And that one of the teachers said that she would have quit in the first year of teaching had she not have a woman of color who was teaching her and when she was becoming a teacher, studying to be a teacher, that she said, you know, like, it's all a guise, them saying that they want diversity, and that and like warning her for what she'll face. And that at the near the end of the article, a lot of them say that they're planning on leaving because of the lack of respect. And there's a lot more than just, I mean, they're also, you know, they're and that they have protective mechanisms, but it gets exhausting. And they often, you know, and they have to joke their way out of a lot of these situations. But it wears on them. And I think also in health psychology, I've learned that if you don't have respect at your workplace, you're more likely to die earlier. So the lack of, and a lot of them say that, like, after years of being there, the discrimination they face goes down. But that means, but I feel like that's what I saw from that, is that they're not really seen as people when they come into this place, and that it takes years for them to be seen more as people. And that also because Asian women are expected to be silent when they have spoken up, they will always be remembered for how they're speaking up. Like, one of them was like an African parent of a student was speaking about how he thought it was unfair how they were treating his child. And all the other teachers were talking about him like rudely, and she stuck up for him. And then they always remembered her for that. Like, why is she speaking up? And I, you know, because, and that's partly is because she wasn't expected. And I think just, it's, what I take from this is that, like, in my own life, like, I've had, I think, like, it's also what the teachers see. Like, if there's 40% of the student population is Asian kids, but mostly they see white teachers. And then what they do see the Asian teachers, they leave earlier. Or what if, like, they see how their Asian teachers are being treated by the rest of the staff? Or they see the declining mental health, a lot of these Asian teachers, that they might not be able to support as best as they would want to. And I think that, you know, teachers are huge role models. And I think that, there definitely needs to be more research. And the fact that there's basically, like, a couple of research articles about this is really appalling, because it's such an important position.
I think that's really interesting. I was just reading a thing about Rate My Professor, which I think, like, every university college kid knows. You can go on to Rate Your Professor, and they've done studies not specifically focusing on women of color, but they've looked through the reviews and the ratings that women professors will get versus male professors. And it was really interesting, because exactly what you said at the beginning, like, for women specifically, it always focused on their looks, and, like, their ratings were, I believe they were usually lower. And yeah, every, like, a lot of the reviews. And then I think they actually brought in at one point, Rate My Professor brought in a thing where you could, like, rank how hot the professor was, which I don't know why you would do that. I think that just led to, like, more, yeah, like, sexualization of these people and the objectification of them when they are specifically being a professor at a university. Like, that's a prestigious position. Like, you're very highly educated. You're there because, you know, you're able to talk on these topics, and then to only be looked at for how you look, and that's how you gain respect, is that's very wrong. You brought up this quite a bit when you were talking about it. But I think when we're discussing women of color, it's important to understand, like, how different women are hypersexualized depending on their race. So what I've, like, read throughout my education and, like, just recently is, like, how young Black girls are typically I don't think that, I don't know how to word this, but like kind of adultized, like they're treated as adults at a very young age. And they're always seen to just be like, oh, aged up. I believe that's how they're referred to. So they're always aged up and they're treated like adults. So a lot of the discussion is about how young Black girls never get to be children, because as soon as they begin to develop, which is completely natural, everyone goes through puberty, but they're from that moment seen to be fully grown women and treated by society. And the same thing happens to Black men as well. I've read also how Asian women, when we talk about the hypersexualization of Asian women, and the articles that I've read, similar to what you were saying, Anastasia, how the stereotype is that Asian women are silent and they're seen as more docile. And I think like the word that I think of is infantilized, because I like a lot of representation I see of Asian women is like they're childlike, so they're obedient, they listen, which is very, very wrong. And I found specifically this quote that I was reading in an article called The Deadly Consequences of Hypersexualized Asian Women. And the quote is, quote, "But more often than not, Asian women are either voiceless or they are sexualized or both. Submission, but also man-eating dragon ladies possessing the secret of the Orient. I can think of so many perfectly acceptable movies that were ruined by how Asian female characters were portrayed," end quote. So the author in that article also brought up, and I've seen, so she brought up the scene in Mean Girls, and I'm sure lots of people have seen that movie. And the thing is, like, I think a lot of these movies from the early 2000s, and even now, we just think about them and we don't realize the problematic portrayals. But she brought up like the Asian teenage girls that are shown to be seducing the coach. And then I think there's also a scene where they show them fighting over him. I totally understand that when we grow up with this representation, and again, like as a white person seeing that portrayal, we begin to understand that that's how people behave. And then for Asian girls to grow up seeing that as themselves and the representation that they, like if that's the only representation they're given, is also not healthy. So I think what a lot of people say, like representation truly matters.
Yeah. And that also then that's, yeah. And that there's a, it's like a binary with, that like women of color have to be one or the other of this extreme. And that, and yeah. And that, and in the interview, they talk about, that too, that, you know, like, it's not something that they can escape. And it's not even something that they can really, and no, it's not something that they can change, because it's something that that's put on them. I'm thinking of like the Asian teacher's experience, like, you know, like it was focused on their looks. It was focused on this, like, and one guy, and he was an ex-vet, was this thing like, oh yeah, Asian women make great wives. Like my wife is Indonesian, like, and that was his way of connecting, but it wasn't that at all. But it's that, like, if he's married, like that's how inescapable it is. That stereotype is, it's everywhere. It's that people surround him, and that you can have a husband who sees you and everyone like you in the same way.
Yeah. And I think also you brought up the experiences of Indigenous women and girls at the beginning a little bit. And I think, yeah, that's also something that we don't talk about. And I can't remember the date, I should know it, but it was in May, and it was, I believe, the Visibility Day of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. And I think a lot of people in Canada specifically, I'll focus on that, we tend to have this notion that like we're so much better. We have this very high and mighty personality as a state. And it doesn't, like, a lot of people don't understand the levels of violence that Indigenous women and girls face and how it's ignored. And I think a lot of people, when the report came out, the national report, they saw that as like closure, like specifically white people. in Canada as like, okay, we've looked at the problem, like we know the stats, but yeah, like learning the information, but then how do we go about like stopping? Because it's a crisis, it truly is. And I think when people dismiss the use of that word and the use of the language to put emphasis on it, it diminishes the experience of Indigenous women. And I also was reading an article and they mentioned costuming. And so like how that plays a role. And back in one of our first episodes of this year, we talked about racist Halloween costumes. And one of the biggest ones is dressing up as an Indigenous woman. And so we see dresses like Pocahontas, the cartoon. And that just continually perpetuates the notion that like, we have to understand Pocahontas as like assault of a young girl, but we treat it as like this feminist, like, I can't think of the right word, but yeah, we're like, we keep, I think it also like is the aging. I'd have to read more about this, but I'm very sure that Indigenous women and girls are aged very similar to the way that I was mentioning that Black girls are.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, I think, again, it's just to talk about these things and truly understand the impact that they have.
Yeah, I was thinking that because they're aged up and also, and then they're easily hypersexualized at such a young age. And it does make me think of, and the fact that, I mean, that it's been going on for so long, too, that like in the Scientific American article, she mentions how like before the Chinese Exclusion Act, they banned immigration of Chinese women because they like showed them as being like prostitutes. Yeah. And I mean, and also that's something that like with Indigenous women, like most of the Indigenous women that go murdered or that are murdered or missing, they're not involved in sex work, but that is, and I'm only saying that because a lot of people assume that the victims are involved in sex work, even though there are the Indigenous women who are in sex work are the most targeted. So they also are like suffering from,
I think, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Like the notion and idea that when women or young girls face sexual abuse, rape, trafficking, like we equate it to, oh, like they are part of the sex work industry. And yeah, some of them are, but it's also like, I think it plays into the entire victim blaming narrative, which I think most of our listeners would understand what that means, that like we seek to find a reason why, like why it's them, like why wasn't someone else, like why specifically were they the victims, and ignoring the entire system of sexism and racism, white supremacy that protects the people who perpetuate violence against specifically women of color. And I think I was also reading the book Hood Feminism, and I haven't finished yet, but I was just reading this one part where Nikki Kendall, the author, talked about how it's a very fine line that protects white women, because we have to acknowledge that white women, when we talk about sexual violence, do face privileges of being white. Yes, they are women, but we still have to acknowledge the privilege of being white. But I like the way that she wrote about it, because she said it's such a fine line. It's because then we get to questions, well, were you drinking? What were you wearing? Why were you there? And I think understanding that, you know, freeing one section of those people isn't freedom for all, but if we have freedom for the people who are marginalized most by sexual violence, then we do achieve freedom for all of us.
And also why women are victims and perpetrators of stereotyping, like, and like specifically the Asian teacher example, like a lot of like white women were also stereotyping them in their workplace.
Yeah, so I want to talk about a specific example of when we think about the hypersexualization of women of color, specifically Asian women. So I'm sure a lot of people who are on TikTok in the beginning of April saw videos that were talking about how the term Asian women was being censored on the new TikTok caption feature, which apparently was only in the States. But I'm sure a lot of people in Canada got those videos too. So a lot of people speculated that the reason why it was being censored is because I'm not a computer scientist, but they were using porn search terms to sort through and to know what terms to censor, essentially. And so I thought this was interesting. I don't know that much about the porn industry or how censoring works when you're talking about automatic captions, but I did some research and I looked at the year in review for 2019 for Pornhub, because I was curious what those categories and search terms were. So specifically, they reported Pornhub that the top search term in 2019 was Japanese, and that was also the most viewed category. And also at the top of the list was Korean and Asian. And so I think it's important to understand that the majority of users for Pornhub live in the United States, according to their status or their data. They also, in the article for the year in review, they credit the rise in the search term of Japanese to the rise in usage of Pornhub in Japan. But again, I think it's important to understand that we have to look at that the US makes up the vast majority of users. So anyways, I thought that, again, I didn't do like research to make like a strong connection, but I don't find it that hard to believe that there could be a connection there, because even for myself as someone, like, I think we see it in media all the time, as we were talking about just like a little bit earlier, how hypersexualized Asian women are. It's important to understand that, like, this is, as you were saying, like, it's in everyday lives for women of color. It's not something they can escape. It's not something that just goes away. It's even in, you know, artificial intelligence, which, you know, people always say that computers aren't biased, but all of it is written by people. You know, we're not to the level where we have technology that is completely free of human bias.
Yeah, like, that's something I definitely want to stress in this conversation is the everyday, because I think that's what a lot of white people are very blind to, especially from like what I've read of like Asian female experiences and other women of color, is like that they like one of the women in the article said she like was begging her husband and his friend to like stop saying she was being paranoid about her feeling that she was in danger. And that's what's also is about the bringing up the Atlanta shooting, is that it's not something surprising, and it's not something that, you know, people could have talked more about it. And I feel like, and that's something that I think a lot of people that aren't that are white miss out on. They might think, oh, this is so shocking, when in fact it's the opposite. Yeah. Because of how sexualized and how normalized like hate against Asians is, and against all people of color. But mm-hmm. Personally, I've seen Asian people were really just like, I remember growing up and there was a lot of stereotypes. I feel like we knew not to say the N-word, even though that racism was still there and there was a lot of microaggressions. But I remember clear insults and like pulling your eyes and like, and I remember that being very accepted growing up. Mm-hmm. And so for people to think now that this, what happened was shocking, which it was shocking, of course, but it wasn't not expected. And it wasn't something that people were living and were experiencing.
I encourage our listeners to go back and listen to our microaggressions episode, because we specifically talk about this quite a bit with our guests, how like these microaggressions, smaller acts that typically as white people, we don't have to focus on, how they do lead, they contribute to the violence that is perpetuated. I said at the beginning, and I just want to stress it again at the end, like, this is in no way like a complete analysis of this entire topic. You could speak about this topic for a very long time. There's a lot of nuance in it. There's a lot of different experiences. But I just want to thank the listeners for listening to this conversation. I hope that you'll stay tuned for the interview that's coming up next with Danica from the Slice Mango Collective in Vancouver. And yeah, thank you again for listening.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyber web? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of 2 or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
Hi, my name is Tamwani.
Hi, my name is Tahia.
Hi, my name is Chimgi, and we'll be hosting this interview for Intersections. So, hello everyone. Today we are here with Danica from the Slice Mango Collective. So I'll do a brief intro, and then I'll give you the chance to give a better one, maybe expand on your work, the work of the collective, or anything else you want to share, really. So Danica Rent is a second generation Filipino immigrant based in Vancouver. She is committed to advocating for and working with the various communities she finds her sense of identity and belonging in as a woman of color. Currently, she's the external outreach coordinator of Slice Mango Collective, an organization whose collective values include providing a space for Filipinx youth to celebrate their cultural identities and recently activism in protecting existing spaces and resources important to Vancouver's Filipino community. So welcome, Danica. And did you have anything else you wanted to share or add to that intro?
I think it was pretty good, but thank you for having me. So I feel like most people would know Slice Mango Collective from our Slice of Support campaign, which started in March. We started that out because we heard of some development that was going to be happening in the Joyce Collingwood area. And it was going to disproportionately affect Filipino-owned businesses and one Chinese-owned business. So we basically like sprang into action and just did our best to organize and get the city to try to listen to what we have to say and like our opinions based on like what we thought was going on with the development and how we felt the community wasn't really consulted in terms of what was going on. And yeah, pretty much that's everything.
Yeah, I remember that's when I first heard of the Slice Mango Collective, of seeing that campaign and hearing that work. Yeah, so I guess today we're here to discuss like the sexualization of women of color and or the hypersexualization, desexualization, and how that can lead to violence. And lead to like real life impact beyond media, beyond, you know, on a higher level. So I guess I'll just get started. So basically, we were wondering what your take is on the relationship between race and the or hypersexualization of women of color in the Western context, like what that looks like.
I guess when you first ask that question, the first thing that comes to mind is the Atlanta shootings that happened in March.
Yeah.
At that time, I remember that our collective was doing our campaign. Then we heard about what was happening in Atlanta, and we just sort of had to take a pause and reflect like what all of that meant to us, because like we saw racism in the form of like our community being disproportionately affected by this development. Then we see across the continent that this man, this white man, goes into two massage parlors, shoots and kills about 8 people, I think was the final like count. And most of them were Asian women. So to just, it's pretty easy to see as a woman of color, as an Asian woman of color, that even though the media was like, oh, he was having a bad day. Oh, he was like, you know, trying to get rid of his temptations. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to see as a woman of color. And with my personal experience with, I guess, a lot of Asian women have had this experience of like, we just knew it was hypersexualization. We just knew that his intentions were like violence against Asian women, just stemming from his like beliefs of like, I don't know, his like stereotypes about us, like any fetishization that he had regarding like women like us. So that's pretty much the first thing that came to mind when you asked that question. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, definitely. That's the first thing. I think it is just, it's like such a recent collective trauma as well. So yeah, definitely the first thing that I think of too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there is so much to unpack in that, but I think you also mentioned like the role of the media and how they reacted to everything, which is like the news and stuff, but we're thinking, what do you think the role of the media is like more broadly, like not just like the news, but also maybe like movies, TV, film, and how that's like kind of played into the hypersexualization of like Asian women, and yeah, and why it was seen as okay to like kind of objectify those women, even though they'd, you know, woken up today to just go to work, not knowing that that was what was gonna happen. Yeah.
Well, just thinking about the stereotypes that the media pretty much portrays when it comes to Asian women of color, there's two kind of groups that you fall into. There's either like the submissive, like a lotus flower. God, I hate that term, but it's because it makes me feel sick to just say it. You know, you're like that submissive, like flower, so pure, innocent, you know, like, I guess, kind of a fetishization of colonization, just personified. Or you can be the dragon lady, you know, the dominatrix, just like, and it's just like, why has the media just pretty much forced Asian women to be like, why have they forced us to comply and just like fit into these stereotypes? Like, even if we don't like think it's okay, even if we like try to actively fight against like being put into these boxes, we're just kind of helpless to that force of media. Like, media is so prevalent in our society. And so it's like, there's that feeling that you can't win and you're just sort of stuck to just take on one of these personas and you don't really have any consent in the matter.
Yeah, I 100% see that and agree as well. I think my experience is a little bit different being like a Black woman, because even though we do experience the hypersexualization, but I definitely agree that whatever you do, they will find a way to fit you into some kind of category, even if you are actively trying to work against those like innate stereotypes. So yeah, even though Black women are hypersexualized as well, I feel like it's different, but like you can't win with these people. But yeah, 100% agree with that.
Yeah, I totally get it. Like, if I just think about it, like, every like race, every ethnicity of women is sort of oppressed in that different way. And we're hypersexualized in like different stereotypes. And it's definitely a different experience, like your experience from my experience. But like, I guess the one prevalent force is just racism, as terrible as that is to say.
Yeah, for sure. Like, all our representations are like through like the heterosexual like male fantasy, right? And that's who we are and that's what we're depicted as. And so yeah, and even in like personal like interactions, right, like you get that from people, like, you know, if you're talking to somebody on Tinder, you know, like it's all like that's like such a daily life thing that I feel like if you're not a woman of color, you don't have to think about that. You don't have to think about, is my race playing a role in their perception of me, in their opinion of me? But that's like a, yeah, like a built-in filter now, I feel like.
Yeah, kind of, we kind of touched on the gender roles a little bit. And so kind of the next question, we talked a little bit about this hyper-femininity of Asian women and how not only are they sexualized, it's also how they're kind of perceived as these like docile housewives. And just kind of extending that to Asian men as well. We were also wondering what your thoughts are on how these kind of stereotypes affect Asian men. They're often kind of seen as very feminine compared to like white men in the West here.
Yeah, I mean, what is it? Asian masculinity is very, it's hard to pinpoint because first of all, like the term Asian is a monolith. There's so many different ethnicities that kind of lie within the term Asian. But what I've noticed is that when it comes to like East Asian and Southeast Asian, I can speak to it because like I'm Filipino and like the way that our men have been sort of stereotyped is the same way that Asian men have been stereotyped. And it's demasculinizing. Is that the right term? I think it's the right term, demasculinizing. in the sense that like, why is it that like historically imperial forces have just pushed their idea of masculinity onto like East Asian and Southeast Asian men? So why is it that way? And then I guess, for example, in the Philippines, we were colonized by the Spanish. So a lot of our culture still sort of has like Spanish influences. And then we have this similar term, like, I guess other people call it machismo. I forgot what we call it in our culture, but you can just sort of see like these Filipino men just existing in this like state of like hyper masculinity versus like the sort of like docile feminized masculinity that like, you know, the Western world has like pushed upon them. So it is definitely damaging to people to have to just exist with all these forces coming from left and right telling you what you can and can't be. That definitely isn't fair. How come people of color can't establish like their own ideas of like gender expression, not even just masculinity and femininity, because as we know, gender like isn't just a binary. How come we can't express our gender identities the way that we want to as part of our cultures?
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. You're kind of forcing these categories and it's damaging because you can't be your whole self. And if you don't, and trying to work against something is also like, you know, constantly having to think about it. It's just a burden, right? To think about your representation. Yeah, and I think another kind of representation of like Asian women that we see is like this infantilization, like of them as children. And this like comes up in like, you know, it comes up in like porn sites as well, where like Asian women are, yeah, it's like you're adding this another like gross layer, right, of sexualizing children in a way, you know, and then putting that together with Asian women and kind of like, and you're also just kind of taking away their, I don't know, you're to act like someone not an adult is like, and treating them like that is, yeah. So I guess my question is like, what are your views on that kind of portrayal of Asian women?
Well, first of all, it's pretty gross to think about. Yeah. Just like the way that we're feminized, but also like, what is it, the like our femininity has to come with just like childlike beauty standards. That's not, yeah, okay, like at, yeah, all. It's definitely weird.
yeah. And I think, oh, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say with the infantilization, I think it plays out, as we were saying, like before, in like day-to-day interactions, not just like like in the sexualization context, but also I know like I always get my nails done at like a Vietnamese places, and sometimes like when white women will walk in and like start talking to them as if, you know, they're like children. But so it's not just like a thing that like men are putting on to like women, it's also like different people can play a part in that infantilization. And I think it plays out in different ways that are equally gross. It's not right, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like I've definitely seen that with my parents too. And my parents are like fully grown adults, right? But because they're like immigrants, you act like they don't understand, you know, and they know less, right? And it's like, yeah, it plays into the whole race for sure. No matter, I mean, I've seen it from all different types of people as well. So it's not always just white men. The white men, you know, play a big role in sexualizing Asian women for sure. Yeah.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca. This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
But yeah, I think you also mentioned a little bit earlier, like the historical origin specifically in the Philippines and how like the role of the Spanish colonization of the Philippines played a role into what we've now seen, like the representation of Asian women, maybe like Filipino women, but like, do you know or have any ideas of other like historical origins and more broadly at how this came to be? Or yeah.
Well, it also just isn't the Spanish, because the Philippines also, the Americans occupied it for a while. And I guess the biggest just like stereotype or just the biggest joke is just like, no, you're gonna see, for example, you're at a family party and then you see that like your aunt, who you don't really know how you're related to her. You just know she's a relative and she's there with a white guy that she's married to. And it's just sort of like that weird like joke of like, oh, haha, like what is it? Like she got a white guy, and it's like that's the stereotype in our culture. But if you look at it the other way, it's a little more sinister, because I'm not saying this about like all expats, like a lot of expats from like America, Canada, the UK, for example, they tend to like go to the Philippines for a while to just like retire or like settle down or try to like take a break from work. And a lot of the times they come and they have sort of an intention to like find a Filipino girlfriend or wife. Mm. And their reasoning is a little bit like, oh, I like Filipino women, when you ask them, because they're like, oh, they provide for you. Or they're like, they're not like these American women. Like, do you remember that meme that was like going around last year about 90 Day Fiance? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Big Ed, and I think her name is Rose. They like ultimately broke up, which, you know, good for her. You know, everyone's yeah. happy, I think, in this now that they're not a couple. But like, it does feel kind of sick to see like people from your homeland just being like commodified in that way. Because these are people we're talking about. These aren't just like, you know, things that you can go buy and be like, oh, I like that one. I want to take that one home with me. And I guess that's just like another way that, like, historically, because like the Americans came over to the Philippines and were like, oh, I like it here. I like the women here. You know, they didn't explicitly say that, but you know, that's like a part of it that's built into it. And it's just kind of gone on for generations. You know, it's a little weird to think about, just to see people, you know, of your ethnicity being commodified like that.
Yeah, I think it's so important as well that you brought up like 90 Day Fiancé, because I think it goes back to like the media, the role of the media. Like that Big Ed is like popular for, I think last year was his season or whatever, but like that show consistently always has a relationship between like white guys going to some part of Asia, I think usually like the Philippines, and yeah, they'll just be like, oh, I just like Asian women, and it's like, what is
what does that mean?
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with obviously, but yeah, it just comes across as not good. And I think I recently read a book by Kathy Park Hong, which is Minor Feelings, and I highly recommend that to anyone who's interested in this topic. I think you'd really get a lot from it, but she was talking about kind of the historic origins and of how like the sexualized or like even things such as surgeries like double eyelid surgery was kind of done in historically because of white men who were going to these Asian countries in periods of war, which again that relates it back to like imperialism, colonialism. And yeah, there was like an American surgeon who was like performing these double eyelid surgeries, and it started off there because they were trying to make the Asian women more attractive to the white men. And now we see that is now a pervasive surgery in Asian cultures today, but I don't know if many people would know. I was really, really shook about that, but they were also doing that on Asian men to make them less threatening to the white to the white men who are coming there as soldiers. So it's gross.
Yeah, now that you bring up like I guess beauty standards, I guess it's all, like, how do you feel about how, you know, beauty standards now reflecting what like Black women, you know, like their features stereotypically, like how does that make you feel?
It's disgusting. It's gross because
exactly.
It's the things that you would have been made fun of or like would still be made fun. I guess it's actually the same for Asian women. We see it a lot with the like the trend of like that people like
fox
eye.
Oh yeah, the
fox eye like, trend.
Yes. Oh my god.
Yeah, like I said, we're all pretty like stereotyped in different ways. It's different flavors of racism.
Yeah. But like I see that a lot with like the lip injections, where like, you know, if you're Black, you naturally have, most Black people naturally have fuller lips. I have much fuller lips than the typical like white person. And if you look at like, there's these like old like comic books called Tintin or whatever, where they literally portray the Black people as like very dark, like huge pink lips, like making them look as close as possible to apes. And you'd get you'd get made fun of for your big lips. But now when white women have them, it's attractive, it's exotic, it's something to be desired. But when it's on a Black woman's body, it's not. So that's always interesting.
Yeah, we're like some like weird static. Yeah, so we're kind of talking about the ramifications now of like that hypersexualization, just like extending into like Southeast Asia. I know like the like lightning creams and stuff, that's like very big. And I don't think that damage is going to go anywhere anytime soon. Like if you go to any of the countries there, that's still very, very big. And I think it's going to take a long time before, before that goes anywhere. And it's just really unfortunate. And so we kind of wanted to finish off with how that hypersexualization, it results in violence and kind of some of the ramifications that it has for women of color.
Like I said earlier, we're all pretty much stereotyped in different ways, but it's just an overhanging like theme of just racism, stereotyping, And that ultimately leads to violence, because all of the ways that we have been hypersexualized as women of color, they all include a form of like sexual violence. For example, like in Asian women, because we're like stereotyped as like submissive, like we're hypersexualized that way, you know, people will think it's okay to be like, oh, like if she's saying no, that means yes. That is not okay. Just like, yeah. Thinking about it, I just like, oh God, it's like ridiculous to hear, but it's just like how things have played out. Like, for example, if I just like loop it back to what happened in Atlanta, they were just hypersexualized. Like his victims were hypersexualized in his mind to be like, oh, they're temptations for me.
Yeah.
I need to get rid of those temptations. And ultimately, how many people paid the price for him wanting to get rid of those temptations, as he called it? So for Asian women, East Asian women and Southeast Asian women in particular, that sort of being forced into that ideal of being the submissive woman, it opens us up to violence that we do not want nor deserve. I don't know how to speak for like other women of color who aren't Asian or like East or Southeast Asian, but in a way, those like sort of hyper, those ways that they're being hypersexualized, they also include like an underlying theme of like, you got to colonize them, you know, or you have to like show your dominance over them. Like you can take them down even if they're like strong women or whatever. You know, it's not okay that we're being forced into these just like boxes and just these categories of like, I don't know, of whatever, because ultimately it's opening us up to things that we don't want to happen, to have happen to us. So it's definitely not okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're saying like force, like stripping somebody down and just like, to just the these two like some characteristics, right? You make them into, you take away like the human aspect of it, and then they just become temptations or sexual objects, and you, that you can do what you want with, right? So like acting like, yeah, and the way before when you said like just talking about like I like Asian women, like it's just it, you know, you're not talking about them as if they're people, but us if we're people, right? So yeah, really, that opens it up. Once you don't think somebody's like human or a person or the same as you, right? Like with families, and yeah, that it definitely opens up to violence.
Yeah, and I think this plays out, like we were saying before, to more women of color, and even like thinking about Indigenous women and how like this whole like Pocahontas fetish as well. Mm-hmm. To like the missing Indigenous women and girls, and how people don't go looking for them, or in the case of, you know, Black women. And I feel like people think that if Black women are like out there, like you're quote unquote hoes, like you know, in cases of sexual assault and stuff like that, not being believed, or not nobody like looking for you as well. Like there are cases of like in the United States where Black girls just go missing, or Black girls are, you know, put under violence and nobody bats an eyelid. I feel like even the case in Atlanta, a lot of people, you know, to say that it was just a bad day, the police officer, it's like you are undercutting what that meant to that community. You don't care, you know, because at the end of the day, they're just like objects, right? In the context of, on the gaze of the Western ones, which is sickening, but yeah.
Yeah, and like just touching on the Southeast Asian experience a little bit, I think it's a little bit of like you're damned if you do and like damned if you don't, because a lot of girls out here, because of like the beauty standards that have been like put on us, they often try to kind of conform to some of those standards. And like I can speak for myself personally, like when I was, you know, in like middle school, the like thick eyebrows and stuff, which is a very like prominent trait in Southeast Asia, was very like, I was not in. And so like if you were kind of seen as like trying to change your like looks to kind of match with those like stereotypes, the more like Western stereotypes, You're kind of seen as like, you know, trying to shed your identity and your culture, and like you're kind of seen as like trying to be white, which is looked down upon, but then also not being accepted and kind of, you know, being made fun of if you do try to express your own culture and your own heritage. So there's really no kind of winning for us.
Yeah, I think all three of you have mentioned at some point, I guess, just like dating apps or something. But if you just think about like that, like loop it back to the question about like how these, like how hypersexualization just like results in violence. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like this is a universal thing for women of color. We now have to have this filter of like, will this person respect me? And will they not fetishize me? And will I be safe around them? That second one is really, really like,
it's terrible
to think about. That's really scary. Why should I have to go out and just make sure that like whoever I'm going out with won't harm me?
Mm-hmm.
And even, I guess it's like a general thing as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I guess like I can speak to that, like as a woman, like we all have to be worried about our safety. It's just like how it is, unfortunately. But as a woman of color, there's just like that added layer of like, will any stereotype this person will have about me possibly, can that lead to violence?
Mm-hmm.
It's like not something you'll think about in like the forefront of your mind, but it's just there in the back of your mind unconsciously. And that's definitely not okay.
Yeah, like we should just be seen as individuals. Like that should just be, you know, a given, but it's not, right? Like, I feel like I've been on dates before where they like low-key mention or like joke about yellow fever, and then I'm like, I'm out, this is over. And you know what I mean? Like all my attraction is gone. So it's definitely everywhere, you know, and it's been to kind of like in conclusion, maybe I was wondering what you would kind of like recommend, like what should people, if they want to learn more about this, or if they want to, you know, if they're just like hearing about this and they don't know a lot about this topic, like where can they go? I mean, there's a lot of, or what would you recommend? Any books, like anything you particularly really found interesting or?
I mean, for me, I guess it's just like, do what you can to just like listen to the communities that are speaking out about this now. Because like, for example, with the rise of like racism against Asian Americans, a lot of like, I guess, if you want to keep it basic, there's a lot of infographics on Instagram, for example, that are just very easily accessible and that you can read about. But you can also just like go deeper and see, you know, like what sources that they're citing and just like, you know, read into that. Also just like listen to these communities that are finally finding their voices and speaking out, or in the cases of some other communities, like the Black communities and the Indigenous communities, they've been speaking out for a while about these things, but you know, people have historically not paid attention to them. So you have to like educate yourself before you can go out there and just be like, what can I do to change?
Mm-hmm.
But that education also comes with like listening to the voices of these people that are being affected.
Yeah. Okay, and thank you so much for sharing that and all your experiences so far and with us and just being here and being a part of this conversation. But I guess just being mindful of time, I'll bring our episode to a close. I'm sorry that we're like a couple minutes over. But yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh my God, thank you guys for having me. This is pretty nice.
Thank you so much for being here.
Ever since I saw you at the anti-Asian, like UBC Oris, like that event with Small Vancouver as well, I was like, okay, I want to talk to her and like bring her on. I'm really glad you could.
Oh my God, if you guys also want to talk more, like I think I would also reach out to, what is it, Butterfly and Project 1907. They also have like a lot of pretty good resources, and they were also part of that panel. Mm-hmm. And just talking to them, I was like, oh my God, like there's stuff that I didn't even know about. This is amazing.
Yeah.
Like how come people like don't know more about them? So like definitely like, you know, check out what they're doing as well.
This episode of Intersections is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.